again, from talking to the journalists, a lot of them feel like they cannot use AI or they are not allowed to use AI. While if they actually look into the guidelines carefully, or if the editors, for example, are a bit more risk averse or open, more open to explorations, there are some use cases that they are allowed to use AI, but they just are not sure if they can.
Welcome back to A Journalist's Guide to AI. I'm Yumi Wilson, your host, a coach, a professor, and all those other things you know about me. But today is a special day. Today we have with us Dr. Bahare Hirawi. She is a leading expert in AI and journalism and an associate professor at the University of Surrey's Institute for People-Centered AI and a Braid Fellow with BBC R&D. More to come on what that all means, and so we'll learn about that. Now, she focuses on responsible AI use in newsrooms, and that is the big topic, not just in newsrooms, but all around the world in multiple industries. Bahare has advised media organizations on AI strategy, literacy, and ethical implementation, and she's a frequent speaker on the global stage, including a TEDx talk back in 2017. Today, she brings a unique blend of academic insight, industry experience, and practical guidance so we can learn more about what is going on with AI in the media. Bahare, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, to begin things, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the intersection of AI and journalism?
So that's a bit of a long story that I can give you. So my background is computer science or computer software engineering. When I was very young, I started a software development company. I was, I think, 19 when I started it. And then I continued with my master's that was also in kind of information computing area, and then PhD information studies. And as I was kind of finishing my PhD, which was focused on semantic web-based standards for kind of interoperability and integration between different systems and agents, it was around the same time that what the so-called Green Revolution was happening in Iran, which was the time that a lot of foreign journalists were expelled, in a sense, from the country. They were not allowed, and local journalists could not report. And as someone who's originally from Iran, me and my friends were all kind of focused on social media to see how we can get the news and what's going on in the country. And that kind of slowly led me into some understanding of, or the idea that what I'm working on semantic web technologies and so on, how it can come to the rescue of news kind of detection from social media. And at that point, I did start working with a couple of news organizations on kind of breaking news desks and verification and so on. And I learned how unstructured and, in a sense, perhaps random the whole process was, and how much it was dependent on each journalist's network and their social media accounts and so on. And so as I was finishing my PhD, I came up with a proposal for my postdoc to work on something that I called social semantic journalism at that point. And that was my kind of entry into the world of AI and journalism research. And for a few years, I was focused on kind of AI technologies, a lot of NLP at that time and so on how to kind of detect breaking news from social media, how to help verify that content, how to find, I don't know, eyewitnesses that were reliable and so on based on the content that was coming. And then I started a research group that was completely focused on that, and we were working with different news organization. So I can tell you more about it. I can go on. And
that's a lot. That's actually, you know, it's funny when I'm listening and I'm thinking, I want to ask about this. And then, oh, wait, I want to ask about that. So let's back up a little bit to you entered journalism through research or discovery? And how did that happen for you? You mentioned that social media became an incredibly important place for you and your friends and family members to find out what was going on. Was that what led you into the journalism realm?
To some extent, partly, but also kind of a couple of side jobs that I got towards the end of my PhD with news organizations, which were because I was getting more interested in news and journalism. Just being in the newsroom at that time taught me what is going on because I had kind of no idea. And I went in presenting myself as this person who knows how to work with social media. And that was, I think, around 2011 was that, yeah. Somebody who knows about semantic web technologies and so on. So I managed to kind of get some newsroom experience at that time. And that kind of started forming my understanding of how newsrooms work. I won't say still, even after this many years, that I know about journalism so much, but about how journalists work and how newsrooms work and how information flows in between them.
What's really interesting as you talk about your path in 2011, you're walking into newsrooms, kind of educating or trying to show them what they should know about social media. And for me, it's been kind of the reverse. I was a journalist at the Chronicle and the Associated Press way back in the 90s and then the 2000s. And I, in 2011, or by 2012, was working at LinkedIn and learning about social media and then trying to share what I was learning as a journalist about social media. So when we talk about the intersection of AI and really about technology and the newsroom and the media, it seems like you and I have kind of walked into where we are now.
Yes, yes.
So where would you say we are now when it comes to technology, social media, and AI?
Where would I say we are? I guess we are where we are. So just looking back at the ways in which I've worked with journalists and quite a few newsrooms, I've worked with quite a lot of newsrooms, and how AI, I mean, I'm not going to talk much about social media because now everybody is using social media, but how AI and computational tools and technologies have been embedded. When I was working with news organizations in 2011, 2012, it was very hard for me to convince them if it was in a research context, which was a little bit more forward-looking, we're talking about NLP technologies and so on. It was really hard to convince them that something like this could be helpful to you. It was quite hard. They understood social media at that point. So if I told them that this is going to really help you with your breaking news detection from social media, they were interested. But at the same time, the technology was not in a place. We were researchers, so we were researching on the technology and how it could be used in news and media. So it wasn't still in a place that journalists could easily put a keyword or kind of set up a what I was proposing at that time as a kind of a social newswire service to see where the breaking news is coming, just like they had, I don't know, Reuters and AP and so on, kind of define some parameters for what they're interested in, whether it was the country, whether it was the city, whether it was specific beats and topics. There was a lot of resistance. There was some interest, but if the tool was not working immediately, there was not a lot of buy-in. And it took a lot of time for journalists to feel interested and feel like it's something they want. I think data journalism became one of the kind of defining moments, in a sense, for journalists to start feeling interested in data and computation, and some of them start working with some of the more kind of computational tools. And as it was getting more and more prevalent, in a sense, data journalism, even data journalism was hard for me when I was talking to different journalists. Why do you need to, like my TEDx talk that you mentioned, it was all about why would you need to use data in journalism and why would you need to use data in investigation?
Wow. And that was so interesting. That's 2017.
Yeah. So it took a while. And I think really, one was the Panama paper that made my life easy when I was teaching data journalism because everybody heard about it. And then COVID made it so easy to understand and to talk about the use of data in journalism. And then I think when ChatGPT came out, suddenly it was this explosion of interest in AI, and suddenly it made it just a tool that anybody could pick up and use. It wasn't kind of geared towards journalism, or still, I think a lot of journalists are experimenting with Gen AI tools. But I see kind of that release of ChatGPT as a kind of aha moment that journalists were starting to use it as just another tool.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Just to back up a little bit for our listeners and our viewers, you had mentioned NLP techniques, and I know that NLP can mean one thing in one community, neuro-linguistic programming, but I'm hoping that you can like break it down for this audience.
So I'm talking about natural language processing. And so what I was doing around 2012, 2013, my research was on semantic web technologies. And semantic web technologies were, a lot of it at that time was done through natural language processing and so on. And as part of the work we were doing for what I call the social semantic journalism, we were really interested in that extracting people, locations, and so on from the data that was coming from the social media. And that was the kind of challenge at that point. And now a lot of Gen AI tools do them quite easily.
So in thinking about how Gen AI tools are being used frequently now and many, many applications, and actually newsrooms have won awards based on breaking down that big data using tools like ChatGPT, where do you think we are in terms of journalists wanting to use these tools or feeling like there is just no choice?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. And I think it's both or a number of different responses. Like I'm at the moment, as you mentioned, I'm a fellow at the BBC. So 50% of my time is given to the BBC on a research project on responsible AI literacy. So I very systematically, I do interview and talk to a lot of journalists there, but also outside of the BBC. When I work as a consultant or researcher, I talk to journalists a lot. I'd say there's quite a huge variety of journalists when it comes to the use of AI. Some of them are very interested, are very eager to go and learn. They use their own time even because journalists are busy. And one of the problems is often no time is given to them on their rotas and shifts to be able to go and learn about AI. So quite a few of them seem to be doing it out of their own time and going out and learning, especially what I'm kind of seeing in my research is that the younger journalists find it very easy to just pick up information on their social media accounts, TikToks and stuff. And when I ask them, where did you learn about AI? They're just like, we just learned it. And they feel more comfortable. And then there's the group of journalists who don't want to touch it. They feel like for different reasons. Either they feel really overwhelmed by it, or many of them feel like this is not something that the journalists should do, and it's going to devaluate, in a sense, journalism, and therefore have some resistance. There's a wide variety of journalists in between these two extremes, in a sense. From what I'm seeing, a lot of journalists have started experimenting with it, and they are doing it quite... Everybody is finding their own kind of use case for it or how to use it, and from idea generation to kind of helping with mundane day-to-day administrative tasks to summarization. And I work on a project on AI journalism challenge, as part of which we were working with 12 different newsrooms across the world. And they had very different types of use cases when you compare it to larger news organizations, because they were like small teams, savvy kind of journalists. They could very quickly pick up something. They didn't need to go through a lot of approval processes and so on. So it really depends on how journalists are using AI. Another thing that makes a big difference is the kind of workflows in the organization and whether or not an organization allows the use of AI or kind of encourages use of AI. And then big one is AI guidelines, how much of AI can journalists use and how much they understand their AI, their guidelines. Because again, from talking to the journalists, a lot of them feel like they cannot use AI or they are not allowed to use AI, while if they actually look into the guidelines carefully or if the editors, for example, are a bit more risk averse or open, more open to explorations, there are some use cases that they are allowed to use AI, but they just are not sure if they can.
Yeah. And you know, what I'm sensing as well in doing the show for, you know, nearly a year is it's like, I'm a writer, so I don't need a tool to write for me. And the minute or the second that I allow this tool to write for me, I am no longer a writer. In fact, I received an email that said, you know, and they also talked about what are we doing by embracing a tool that could decimate the professional integrity of our industry, you know? And there's that real question. So it, even beyond guidelines and policies, there's a almost an internal resistance because of the identity one embraces when they say, I am a journalist.
Yes, I completely agree. And that is a conversation that comes up quite often when I talk to the journalists. And I kind of probe on the question of writing specifically, because is writing journalism or is investigation journalism or is it all journalism? And I get quite different responses. Some journalists see writing as their main skill. And to them, if AI comes and does the writing, then it doesn't make any sense anymore. And journalists are no longer have the place they had. And the whole process is really devalued and not acceptable. Some others don't see the writing, the final writing, as maybe their main or their only contribution, especially the ones who work on investigative journalism or investigative pieces and so on. Writing is one element, and some of them say that if they can get help from AI in writing, well, they will get the help. Then I think to me is the matter of language. So in a sense, a lot of us live in a country where it is not our native language, which gives people a little bit of disadvantage when it comes to writing. Somebody like me is not a good writer in any language, so that's kind of out of the question. But some other people would be very good writers in their own native language, and there might be completely very professional, good journalists come to another country, and their writing is impacted, or they may not get the same opportunities that another native speaker will get. And they are very much for it because they think those that disadvantage that they had to deal with, they no longer have that.
You know, I think you do raise a great point. I actually have thought about, in a sense, when I think about it, it's like evening the playing field, because all of a sudden we're, you know, I remember when I was first teaching journalism at SF State, it was about where do you put your commas? You know, why do you start with a clause that's so complicated? You know, you've got to take academic writing and really simplify it. And it was a mystery because, you know, so many students, so many writers, and as you mentioned, if English is not your first language and you're learning US journalism and you want to practice that, well, then there's that other, that's another additional barrier. And what I've seen, because I have to a large degree embraced the use of generative AI in so many different ways as a writer, you know, because that's the thing I do identify myself with. And how does it help me? But how does it help people who may think, oh gosh, I've got to really learn this language well, and then if I can't, then I'm not a good journalist. And as you mentioned, that's not true. there are great reporters who feel like, well, with the writing, it takes a bit and we've got to do it as a team. And where AI could come in and help smooth out that language, because it's still their reporting that's so incredibly important.
Yes. To me, again, some journalists would disagree with me, but writing is one part of the work, and there's other elements into journalism. If you think about it, a lot of, like, say, data journalists, they were journalists and they were given tools to be able to work with data. In a sense, data people didn't come to say that, oh, no, you're using our tool and you're not a good, you are not allowed, in a sense, you're not allowed to do it because this is our skill and expertise. If you do it, you're taking away our job. Or a journalist who picked up coding, they just picked up some other tool to help them with their and with their work. On the other hand, there are people who are very good with data. They're very good with using tools to find stories in the data, to find patterns and so on. But they don't have that other end of the skill set, which is the writing, perhaps. So they can, just like journalists have traditionally used computational tools, data tools, to help them with their journalism, people who are good with data also can use writing tools now, or tools that can help them write or kind of formulate ideas a little bit better or nicer than computer scientists normally do to do that. So I think we have so far in the past, since maybe 2010, we've had a bit of a cross-pollination, but it has been mostly from journalists to come to the data. And we haven't had many data people coming to journalism and to communication and to writing. And we at universities have always heard that our students need to learn to communicate. And now there are tools that they can. So this cross-pollination to me is, it can now happen both ways. It's not only one way.
I love that, you know, and I think I'm going to start reframing my discussion that way, because there's that whole emphasis on tools. Yes, this is another tool to help me gather data or make sense of data, big data. It's a tool to help me streamline my day. It's a tool to, you know, help me write all of those SEO headlines that I have to write. But no one, well, very few have discussed how it could also help those who have those tools or skills in those other areas to improve that last part, which is to bring it all together so that the audience really understands why an issue, a topic, is so important for them, you know, as they make decisions about voting, about, you know, policies. And, you know, the purpose of journalism really comes back into play for me when I think about, you know, the bottom line is we're here, if you're in journalism, whether you're educating, whether you're in it, is to inform the community, the public, so that they can make decisions and take action. And if we look at it that way, then writing is a part of that, that it can be a tool to help a lot more communicators get the message out.
Yeah, exactly. And I have had some experiences of data people in newsrooms being, in a sense, disadvantaged not seen to the extent that they should. And I have had direct experience of that myself, that like in a project developing quite a complex tool for getting data from Twitter at that time and processing and then visualizing and so on. And I was told by the editor, it took days and days, and I built on the research that we had done in my research group. And the editor said, talk to so-and-so for the words. And I gave the person, the journalists, all the work and some bullet-like sentences of different types of the way the story could be told, but in bullet points. The journalist wrote, I think, 1.5-2 paragraphs of story and put his own name on it and was not even in the byline. And so I think it really, in journalism, how important words are and how important other aspects of computational work within the context of journalism is, maybe with ChatGPT and the Gen AI tools are now at least being seen a little bit more. And it's kind of people are getting better voice to frame when they have done the investigation, when they have done the research, to now be able to also tell this story or tell part of this story and collaborate with journalists who are very good at writing too.
Yeah, and I just want to back up on the whole idea of research versus writing and content. I mean, if you create the content, you should get the credit. But you're right, there has been a heavy, heavy emphasis on, oh, well, I framed it this way, so I will have the byline. I remember when I was interviewing at the Associated Press, the people interviewing me and some other students from USC where I went, they asked one of my friends who was also interviewing, do you consider yourself a writer or a reporter? And she said, I consider myself a reporter. And I think they even asked to compare her, like compare her work to me, my work, because I think we were, and she said, Yumi, I think is a better writer, but I'm a, you know, something along those lines. They ended up hiring me. And when I called her, not knowing any of this backstory, I said, oh my gosh, blah, blah, blah. And she told me what happened. And I felt horrible, you know, because I don't even think that should be a question, really.
Well, I mean, writing is also an important skill. And we, each of us have a certain set of skills. And then there is a certain set of tools that we can use to fill the gaps where we are not so good at. And sometimes that tool and the gap is working with data. Sometimes that gap and the tool is working with computational tools, and sometimes it's with writing. So yeah, I think there's just different tools to cater for our different skills.
All right. Okay. So let me shift the conversation just to a little bit more to the practical side. Here we are, we're in it. Journalists, communicators are using various tools. Do you have any suggestions, recommendations on things or tools that reporters, editors, photographers could be using, should be using, and thinking about if they're not already?
I could, but I probably wouldn't maybe so directly, because the tools keep changing, and also there's a lot of guidelines and so on in different news organizations that may or may not allow the use of a certain tool. And it doesn't mean if they are not allowing, for example, a lot of organizations now get a Copilot as part of their Microsoft suite, and therefore their data is not sent to the cloud with the agreements that they have. So journalists can use it while ChatGPT may not in certain scenarios be like that. And costs are different for different organizations. So my suggestion would be, one, see what you want to do and how the tool can help you. But at the same time, keep an eye on different tools that are out there. Talk to the people, talk to your colleagues, talk to your both journalists and techie colleagues to see what they're doing and what they're using, and experiment with them and explore them and see how you can use it to your advantage. I'm just having talked to many journalists at the BBC, for example, I can see how personal initiative makes a huge difference, because the organizations might tell you there's this tool and these are the things you can do. But at the same time, they might be quite slow. They might be quite cautious. They may simply not have the resources to send around to tell people what tools are out there every month or every week. So keep an eye, but at the same time, don't be overwhelmed by the many tools that are out there. Tools are going to come out every day. And if you don't know how to use them all, that's okay.
Yeah. And there are so many tools. In fact, you know, I use ChatGPT quite a bit. And first, before I talk about what I use, let's talk about privacy, because you mentioned the cloud. That, you know, for example, Copilot, you know, tells, you know, those who have Copilot, it doesn't go into the cloud. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is the data, or it could go to the cloud. What I mean is the tools do not train on your data. So one of the things that's very important in journalism is you have sources, and also you have some information in the company that you should not send outside. So if you're not putting it on a website out there, you probably would not want to put it in an AI tool, because it is going to their server and they are going to train on it. And yes, maybe one or two instances may not make a huge difference to the result of the training, but at the end of the day, the data has gone out there and it's being trained on.
Yeah. And then With ChatGPT, is it possible to change your setting so that it isn't going into the LLM or, you know, being used to train the model?
That would be, I think, an agreement that at an organizational level you can make. But at personal level, or the accounts that we have as individuals, I don't think so. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think so.
Because, yeah, when I'm doing trainings for AI, I do a lot of prompting type trainings, and the ChatGPT, you know, there is that setting, and they used to have temporary chat that said it didn't train the models too, although that's changed. But what I've noticed on Perplexity and Claude and some other tools, I can't even find that setting, you know, so it's not even like an option unless I, you know, have to dig deep. But I just wondered if even changing the settings, you know, does that matter?
I think a lot of them will only offer that option, like properly not sending your data out and not training on it when you have corporate level agreements.
Gotcha.
But things might change, and some of them might have already changed.
Right.
But I think they're like Google or search engines. They're, unless they can train on data, they are not up to date. So they would be able to train on your conversations.
And speaking of conversations in cloud and all of that, I feel like when I'm just near my phone and I'm talking about, hey, I need to get this sunscreen, 50 SPF, next thing I know, my ads in Instagram or wherever are like all about sunscreen. So I'm almost at the point, and maybe it's just because I'm becoming, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, but it's this idea of like, you're being listened to all of the time. So how much privacy do we really have? I mean, every time we fill out, you know, a subscription or, you know, put our credit card in to buy a product, I'm just wondering like how private things really are. Because I will put a question into ChatGPT, for example, about me, or, you know, it's got everything. It's something I didn't train the model on, but it's in there.
We are not very private at all. I mean, our data is in so many places that I don't think we can even imagine ourselves. But at the same time, I think a level of awareness of what we are putting out there, or like, for example, when I chat to ChatGPT about companies, people, specific pointers, I always change it to XXX or BBB or something. So I personally never put names in there. I even sometimes don't put my own name there, even though I know it knows who I am. But I think that level of awareness is important for everybody to do it, because you're sending it out and many things could happen to this data. And it could really, it doesn't have to be with ChatGPT or any other tool, any subscription that we are making, we're putting all information there.
Yeah, and I think that is a best practice. If you can leave out personal information, phone numbers, things like that, as you're running a search on, you know, maybe you're researching sources, for example, if you can, that does help a lot. But let me ask another question, because I'm noticing Gemini, Google's product now, you know, I'm doing a Gmail, I'm getting that polish option, polish my email. Let's talk about, you know, I don't want to send out a misspelling or an error in my email to an important source, for example. So because of that, my awareness is everything I'm writing, everything I'm doing is being picked up, is being listened to, is being observed.
Yeah, specifically with Google, I feel like it has been like that. And I am not sure. I mean, they have been training on them. Like now we are aware of Gen AI and how they've been trained on the data. But Google has been training on all sorts of data from emails, searches, and so on. And even like Google Trends is there. It doesn't pull out data from the emails, but anything that you search, as soon as you start searching, that's the data you are putting out there. And you're often logged in, and that's kind of, Google knows what you're interested in. And same would go with ChatGPT and so on. They at the moment, they don't have a lot of personalized recommendations in a sense, or ads, but at some point they will.
And when you think of social media back in the day, back in those early days, you know, I was like, oh, everyone's on it. Let's just use it. It's very personal, blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, you know, they looked for ways to make money, and that included personalizing ads that were targeted. And sometimes I'm now looking at a social platform, scrolling through, and it's not like the old days, like every third piece of content is an ad. And so sad, because I'm like, hey, actually, those are ads I want to see because I'm going on a trip and I need, you know, a jacket like that. Yeah, it's really hard, you know?
I think there's a two sides to it. At some level, we probably prefer to get ads that are relevant to us. But at the other level, it means they know everything about us.
Yeah. And I've just been watching this show. I don't know if you heard it. It's called The Feed.
Okay.
It's like a sci-fi dystopian. But the idea is that you have within your brain some sort of device that you can run, like it looks like an, you know, a social media feed, and you can broadcast, you can share that all through your brain. And yet now there are ramifications and dangers and, you know, all of that. But what I thought was interesting is it's kind of like our phone, if you think about it, you know, it's like we keep this with us all the time. It's some of us will sleep with it, and without it, we feel a little bit lost, and we're constantly communicating through that. It almost feels like we're headed toward that, where we are sharing so much with AI. And I was reading an article just the other day. Many people, perhaps younger generations, are, you know, asking about, oh, I've got this illness and, you know, tell me about that. Or I'm having a relationship issue, you know, coaching. It's becoming personal confidants. And boy, what I imagine it's training the data on in the future.
Training at large scale is one thing, and then training at your individual personal level, that all this data is connected to you and all the conversation you have with it as a therapist. And yeah, as you said, dating, I've had people asking dating questions. This person messaged me this, what do you think? What do you think they mean? Sometimes it really works, actually.
Yeah.
I have people who said that I listened to ChatGPT and look, now I have a girlfriend or something. So part of it works. Part of it, we still, I think, need to be about ourselves. We are choosing what to put out there. Okay, so I may choose to share it with ChatGPT about something or not. But when we are putting other people's data out there, especially as journalists, journalists have always been careful with sources, and sources will reveal information to the journalist in confidence. And then there's also data protection and privacy laws there, that you are not supposed to give personal information or put it in the public kind of space. And sometimes journalists are not aware that if they put this spreadsheet in ChatGPT or Copilot, if it's not a closed one, they are sending it out there. That information is going out there, and this is the information that should not go out there. Or I don't know, or HR information even. I've heard people saying that we have disinformation about our guests or participants or even sources, and we sent it to ChatGPT and said, give us the highlights.
Yes.
They're putting all information.
Well, and then you've got Otter AI and Fireflies and a number of transcribing, note-taking, you know, systems that make many people's lives easier. But what does that mean? It means that now you've given this very personal interview information to, you know, another cloud-based, you know, app and program. It's kind of a slippery slope in a way.
It is, and it is challenging, because when you compare journalism to research, like for a research that I needed to do, I had to write pages and pages of research protocol. And as part of that, it's all about where is the data stored? How is the data handled? Is it transcribed? What transcription service are you using? And it's, in a sense, sometimes you feel so restricted that I am not allowed to record an interview on my phone. And for example, in our case, if we are recording an interview, it needs to go directly on the university server. So that presents itself as a hurdle, because any time I want to go and talk to a new group of people, I need to go through months, could take 6 months, for example, at our university, of approval. On the other hand, a lot of the times when you talk to journalists, consent is not something that's even discussed, or in meetings within the organizations, consent is not something that's discussed. And all this information, as you said, it's going to the cloud and it's going sitting somewhere with all the things you've said and all the things other people have said in your organization.
Well, and for many years, you know, the way that I, learn my education and then train, you know, as a teacher, educator, I said, if you identify yourself as a journalist from the get-go, that is, you're saying, hey, I'm going to be interviewing you. I'm going to be recording you. So there's almost an assumption made. And then, of course, we've been trained also to know on the record, off the record, and deep background. But other than that, you're right that photojournalists and journalists, certainly here in the U.S., do feel like by having a press pass or a shield or a, you know, that identity is what gives them the access and the, perhaps even the permission, assumed permission to go ahead and start recording, you know, especially if I'm on a public street and I'm watching you walk out of the building. That's how we are trained in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably in different geographical locations, different rules might mean people can act slightly differently. But still, even within an organization, that concept of consent is not really discussed or thought about in a sense.
You mentioned corporate solutions. So I do want listeners and viewers to know that there are many larger companies, that certainly those with, you know, a budget. They are using AI tools, but that are kind of with their own servers and their own kind of protected walls, so their data doesn't get out. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I think the idea is that a lot of them do, at least in the newsroom kind of media space. I know better. I don't know how the tech companies, for example, large tech companies would do. But at the end of the day, people are so used to using tools like ChatGPT. That even if some tool is protected within the organization, you will see leaks from the kind of side uses of AI or dark uses of AI, that information goes out. And it requires really a lot of training and literacy, kind of very specific types of literacy, to make sure people are aware of what they're putting out there. But at the same time, a lot of the newsrooms, even larger ones, when they're using the tools, some of the tools they can close it off, but some of them they just come to an agreement that, okay, you're not allowed to train on it, but it is still being sent to your server. And sometimes there are rules on which server they will use. Like if it is in the US, some of the Europeans may not want to use it at the moment, and they would want to use European servers. So the AI companies will have different servers that they could offer and so on.
So you mentioned training and getting in there and making sure that researchers, reporters, journalists, communicators know about, you know, privacy and what to share and all of that. Is that part of what you do?
Yes.
And what are the other projects that you're working on, things that you do when you go to newsrooms or can offer people?
I can talk a little bit about the project I'm working on, and also kind of I do help news organizations with AI strategy and AI guidelines and AI policy, kind of putting in place programs that could help the journalists to kind of use AI responsibly. And from organization to organization, it's very different what responsible use of AI could mean. For the BBC, for example, is trust is very important for the BBC. So an organization like the BBC would never jeopardize the trust, even if it means they are slower and it will take them some time to kind of pick up some of the technologies or use it in their organizations. But when it comes to training and literacy programs, it is quite tricky because a lot of news organizations don't have the in-house skills and expertise of AI. And sometimes when they bring skills and expertise from outside, it's not specific enough to the kind of use case they have in the newsroom, or they don't understand the newsrooms. And training literacy, or literacy is not only training. There's many different ways that could be put in place for journalists to help each other learn, in a sense, even at the level of peer learning or group learning, to kind of share knowledge and information and examples with one another to see how they can, in a more sustainable way, grow together and learn together. And one of the things that I see with literacy and training programs is this tension between teaching the journalists those kind of privacy and ethical aspects, to a point that sometimes you would hear that larger news organizations especially have taught their journalists. When I talk to journalists, they say, we have learned about what not to do. We haven't learned about what to do. And I think that kind of, we are at a place that a lot of news organizations, especially the ones that are very responsible, have told their journalists what not to do. At the same time, they're telling them, yes, you can use AI tools, but they don't know how they can do it. And they're very afraid of picking them up because they feel like it might still go to that what not to do that they told us.
You know, that's kind of interesting you mentioned that, because in 2024, I was invited to moderate a panel of small newsrooms that were using AI in creative ways because of, smaller budgets. That was 2024. And this year, I'm going back to ONA, which is in New Orleans this year in September, and they are going to have me do an AI prompting slam. So to go from theory or kind of, case studies, to let's get into it. Let's try these prompts and these formulas that might help you get the results you want is kind of saying what you're saying, which is people are asking for, okay, if you're wanting us to use it, we would like to know what are ways we can use it, how can we be responsible about it, but we want to have some guidance on that.
Exactly. So I have also heard that from a lot of journalists. They like the idea of experimenting and exploring, but at the same time, they say, one, we don't have a lot of time to sit down and experiment around. So they really like the idea of somebody coming and telling them, look, this thing that you can do, and it's easy, and it's going to save you so much time. And it's also a safe way of doing it because, for example, in a large organization like the BBC, we have got approvals to do a project like this, and you should be able to do that too. So people really, really are eager now, journalists, I find, to learn more and to see how they can use AI and how they can do it responsibly.
Well, I think that is a perfect place to pause our interview. And Dr. Haravi, I want to just thank you so much for sharing your insight, your knowledge, and giving us some hope, really, around what we could be doing as journalists, communicators, and media professionals. So thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
So I want to thank everyone for listening and watching this episode. Comment below if you have any questions, or leave a comment on any of the social platforms. Visit my website, yumiwilson.me. See you on the next episode.